Phil is studying of Torah, whether for a Jew or for a Ben Noah.
Okay.
No difference in that score. So what I would like to do in the classes that I give, I would like to concentrate not so much on material, because I've listened to a number of the presentations for the B'nai Noah, and a lot of times there's a lot of material. Material is important, of course, but what we really have, everything hinges on the oral law. And the reason why the oral law is so important, it's the heart of everything, because it is the method of approaching the Bible. And with this method, you can understand what the Torah is talking about. And that's what God wants us to do, to study and to understand the Torah, not just to read it through. And this method, of course, is the only method in existence from time immemorial till today. There is no other method. There is no other system of interpreting the Bible. People can read the Bible any way they want, but no one can claim an authentic method of studying the Torah. And as I mentioned in one of the articles I wrote about the seven mitzvot of B'nai Noach, that's the oral law. And everything we do, the living system of Torah, is the oral law. The oral law has in it a method. The important thing is to try to learn that method, the method of thinking. And I've had a number of conversations with David Davis, and he knows that it's not theology. It's a different kind of thing. Okay? I guess that's between us. All right. Okay. What I want to do tonight is I would like to take an area of the Torah reading from last week. I'm going to start giving a series from the beginning of Genesis. Now, with the Torah, since it's God's word, the approach has to be just like you'd approach another area of God's works, which is, for instance, science and the universe. And we know that we as human beings, we have limited minds, and we can't expect to just understand the whole universe. It took science centuries and centuries just to know what is meant by time and space, which would seem to be the most simple thing. And all the mistakes of the early physicists were based on the fact that they didn't have any concept of time and space, a proper concept, and everything you do is always in terms of time and space. If you want to measure the speed of an object, you have to speak about time and distance. And it turned out that time and distance was something a bit different than what people intuitively felt. So you see that when it comes to God's works, you can't be that demanding. You have to be patient, and you have to be willing to... That's when method really comes in. Once you learn the method, you know that an idea has to conform to a certain type of configuration and has to satisfy the mind. If it doesn't satisfy the mind, you don't know what it is. And we're happy to walk away many times and say, we just don't understand it. Maybe 10 years from now we'll understand it. Maimonides says that there were parts, the most difficult parts of the oral law, the areas that have to do with Tumah and Tahara, cleanliness and uncleanliness, and that's with regard to the temple. But that's the most abstract area, very abstract area. And Maimonides says that even prophets didn't fully grasp certain abstract points when it came to that area of Torah. So God's knowledge is infinite, and we sort of just try to grasp as much as we can. We scratch the surface. But we have to always, the important thing is to be faithful to the approach and not to force our minds into types of thinking that don't make sense just for the sake of feeling that we have mastered the area. So I want to take an area today of the Torah reading that we did last week. And as I said, even though it's not in order, because I'm going to go back to the beginning of Genesis, but I don't think it matters. I'm taking this area first because, first of all, it's just last week's reading, and secondly, I think in an easy way, it gives you some kind of insight in how to approach an area. What we're doing tonight is Genesis 25, the last week's reading, which was basically, it begins with Genesis 25:19. And it goes through to the end of the reading is 28:9 is the last verse. Okay? So I'll try to go slowly. If I'm jumping ahead or not too clear, just interrupt me. And we in Torah, we're really very informal in our study practices. You notice when I person gets ordination, many times you get ordination without even passing one test, one exam, because it's an informal kind of study, and the teacher is always and has a constant rapport with the student. He knows how much he knows, he knows how much he doesn't know. So there's no need for any formal type of test. And when we give a class, it's not a lecture. We stop, we think intermittently. Sometimes in the middle of a class, I'll just put my head down on the table and just think for a half hour. So, it's a process that we go through rather than just a lecture. And sometimes, you know, the teacher gets stuck, the students get stuck, and we just sit around and put our heads together and try to work it out. We don't worry about these type of things. It's very informal. Now, the beginning of the last week's Sedra, that means the reading. I know a lot of you do know, are familiar with a lot of the words, but in case I say one and you don't know what it is, just be sure to talk up. Now, the reading is a story about, it says, these are the generations of Isaac, the son of Abraham. Abraham gave birth to Isaac. Now, I'll just start off with this. This is a small point. It doesn't have to do with what I'm going to get into a little later. I realize I have 1 hour. I think I used up about 7 minutes already. So I'll just take this one point. That the this is a point that's from Rabbi Soloveitchik. There's a Rashi over here. Of course, in order to gain deeper insight, I said you must make recourse to the oral law. And the genius of Rashi, is not an originator in this area where he gives his interpretation. What he does is he made the best selection of the oral law that really opens up the text. But of course, when you read Rashi, you have to use your own mind to bring it out. Now here Rashi says that Abraham gave birth to Isaac. So Rashi states that the people in the generation that were deriding Abraham, they said that really Sarah became impregnated from Avimelech. You remember that Avimelech took Sarah for one night, and he captured her, and then in a dream he had a vision that he had to return her to her husband. And you know the whole story. So Rashi says that over here, what it means, why is there's a repetition in this verse? Because it says these are the generations of Isaac, son of Abraham. And then it says Abraham gave birth to Isaac. Well, obviously, if Isaac is son of Abraham, so Abraham gave birth to Isaac. Why the repetition? So the oral law steps in here and says that the reason is because the people in the generation that were deriding Abraham, they said that Isaac really came from Abimelech, and the king. And God, in his divine providence, through his divine providence, he made sure that Isaac had the same exact appearance as Abraham. So no one could say that it wasn't from Abraham. Now we have to understand what the importance of this is, and even though this has to do with the nation of Israel, I know that Ben Noach is interested in understanding the whole of the Torah. Whether it has to do with the nation of Israel or has to do with him doesn't really matter, because it's all part of God's plan, and we're all interested in God's plan. So it's not a personal thing. It's simply, it demonstrates the way that God works with his divine providence. Now, what is the importance of these people deriding Abraham and saying that Isaac was not from Abraham? So Rabbi Soloveitchik said an interesting interpretation, which I think is correct. Once you hear it, you'll see that it has the meaning. He says that Abraham, when he came into the world, he started a whole new philosophy, as you know. And he ridiculed the idolaters. He demonstrated to them, as Maimonides said, that idolatry is nonsense. And the person has to be able to see God through the natural law and not to look for these crazy type of miraculous and superstitious things which the idolaters are practicing. He explained to them the idea of one God and that God is non-physical. And it was a whole new way of life. The Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, seven laws of the Noahide. And, of course, whenever somebody comes up with a new idea, revolutionary idea, he's not really accepted that readily. As a matter of fact, those who don't follow his way of life are opposed to him, and sometimes they can get quite violent. We have a tradition of the oral law that Abraham was in great danger, really just escaped with his life from Ur, from the land of Ur. You might be familiar with the story of the of Nimrod throwing Abraham into the fiery furnace. Well, we don't know whether that is actually literal, to be taken literally, but Maimonides says there was, at any rate, some miracle that occurred to Abraham, and he escaped. Now, the reason why the people wanted to say that Isaac was not the son of Abraham is because when he started this new philosophy, people who were against him, and he had a lot of opposition, as you would well understand, it would be like what you're doing, actually, in opposition to the existing religion of the day. And Abraham, as you know, was a member of the religion, and he used to go to the churches of the idolaters. And then as he became older, he started to realize there's something wrong with this. He started to investigate and saw that this is incorrect. And by the age of 40, he came to the full formulation of his ideas concerning God and full recognition that the idolatry is completely false. And those who were in opposition to him, as they saw him age, they had one wish, that this system should die with him. They said, Abraham is an old man. You notice that he doesn't have any children. And just a matter of years now, he's going to die, and there's not going to be any continuity, and we will eventually be victorious. So, interestingly enough, when Isaac was born, this was very upsetting to them. Because here they see there's a son that's going to carry on the same tradition. So immediately, they said, no, this is not his son. They said, isn't it true that Abimelech had Abraham's wife for overnight? And he never had children before that time. Must be that Sarah was impregnated with Abimelech. Now, psychologically, you see, the Torah recognizes the fact that being a progenitor is an important thing psychologically. The greatness of Torah is, of our system of Torah is, that it's not only philosophical, it's also psychological. Takes into consideration the psychological aspects of mankind. And people generally look at an offspring as being the one that inherits and that takes over the system. So these people wanted to deny Abraham's system. They said if he would have died without any children, it wouldn't have been so much a personal loss as it would have been a loss in terms of the system. Now, if you take a look at, let me just find here a second, in Genesis 15, 15:1. So the Bible says that after these things, the word of God was to Abraham in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abraham. I am a shield to you. Your reward is very great." What did Abraham respond? He said to God, "God Almighty, what can you give to me? And I am going childless, and the one that is going to inherit me is Damascus, is Eliezer." And he continues to say, "You didn't give me any seed, and my inheritor is the one that's the head of my household." Now, why was Abraham so concerned about having children? Everybody likes to have children, but Abraham was a great man, and we ascribe to Abraham only great attributes. And we don't say that he wanted to have a child just like any other person, just for his own personal satisfaction. That everybody has. But Abraham was a great man, and he could have foregone the personal satisfaction. But what he said to God was that I have a great reward, but I'm not interested in the reward. What I'm interested in is the philosophy and the ideas, the true ideas I've established should go on, and here, the one that's inheriting me is the head of my household. Eliezer was a faithful servant. He was a very great man, an intelligent man. But the fact is that people are not going to look at him as the one that's carrying on the system. And as much as ideas are important, the personality behind the ideas is extremely important as well. Torah always recognizes this. That's why the Torah has a whole system of law for the scholar. For instance, a scholar, one is not permitted to render a halachic decision in the presence of his rabbi because there's respect for the rabbi as a scholar. One is obligated to stand up when the rabbi enters the room. This is not an honor for the rabbi per se, but an honor for the institution and a respect for the person of the rabbi, because the Torah realizes that you can't separate, psychologically, you can't separate the personality from the ideas. Even though when people gain knowledge, they don't need a personality anymore. They're on their own with the ideas. But in order to establish it, human nature is such that the person is extremely important. And Abraham realized at this point that if he didn't have the personality of Isaac to continue, then is that the system's just going to die. That's why he said to God that, what can you give me? Never mind the reward, that's a nice thing to have personally, but the fact is, everything I establish is just going to go to waste in a matter of years, because I could tell that people are not going to recognize Eliezer, even though he's a faithful servant and a wonderful person and a very intelligent person. So therefore, what was necessary was to have the continuity through someone who was a direct descendant of Abraham. Indeed, the whole idea of establishing the Jewish nation is based upon this concept that the people, you see, there were many philosophers throughout history. Many of them with very good ideas. But over here, what God wanted was not just to have a philosopher that espouses a philosophy, but to have a philosopher that is the progenitor of the people. And since he is the father of the people, this creates a tremendous identification with that image of Abraham. So that Abraham was really a father to all the nations, as the Torah says, which means the entire world, Jew and non-Jew alike. But simultaneously, God, in establishing his plan, knew that there must be a personal identification through the seed of Abraham. Otherwise, the philosophy is just going to die. And in order to keep the philosophy alive, this was a necessity. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says that when God said to Moses, the Bible says, when God said to Moses, I will make you into a great nation. So the Talmud says that Moses answered, he said, if a table that has three legs can't stand, how can a table of one leg stand? That was one of the arguments he used, to say that you must spare the Jewish people, because otherwise everything's just going to be dependent on identification with one person, Moses. That won't do, Moses said. He said, you must have the identification with the three patriarchs. And that's why it is better that in order to establish a nation, it must go back to the three patriarchs. This is a psychological phenomenon. Now, so what happened here was that it was necessary in order to establish the system that Isaac, it should be known that Isaac was the son of Abraham. That's why it says Abraham was the progenitor of Isaac, which means, as the rabbis explain, that he looked, there was no question about it, that he was his father. He looked just like him. This was obvious and manifest to everyone in order that the system should be able to continue. Okay. It's a very interesting thing that you see that when a little bit further, when Isaac, it states that Isaac actually went and he re-dug the wells of his father. You'll notice in 26:13, he became very great, and in 14 it says he had a lot of cattle. And then it says in 15, and all the wells that the servants of his father, servants of his father had dug, the Philistines filled them up with earth. See, this was symbolic because the well was the place where Abraham many times would preach his ideas. And in the middle of a desert, you have a well where people come by and he would discuss their ideas. Now the Philistines closed them up because they wanted his whole system to was a symbolic of the fact that his system was dying. And it says in 18, it says that Isaac returned and he dug up the wells. You see, it means to say that he actually taught the same philosophy and taught the same way of life. And this showed that the ideas and the philosophy of Abraham were not going to die. And at the end of that chapter 26, it says that first they argued, and then it says, verse 22, it says that they dug another well and they didn't argue on it, and they called this well Rehovos, which means verse says, because now God is going to allow us to be fruitful and to expand and to be fruitful in the land, which means to say that again is an interesting psychological idea, which means to say that whenever a person is trying to aspire for a position, there is always a tremendous uphill struggle. And people do not want to accept new authorities. That's the nature of man. Man's nature is such, he likes to economize on his authorities. An authority figure is not something that people accept too readily. Because an authority figure is another person I have to restrict myself, sort of, subserviate myself, I would say is a better way to put it, subserviate myself to another figure. People don't like subservience. So whenever a person appears on the scene, a new person, there's always a tremendous resistance towards him. Once he's established, then it's a different story. When he's established, people recognize him, and he's made it, so to speak, from a psychological standpoint. Usually when the person is old, or many times after the person dies. We all know how many famous people were not recognized during their lifetime. That's because there's always resistance against the person that's alive because there's envy and animosity. Maimonides in his day was very much attacked. And his students used to be very upset about this, and they used to argue and fight on his behalf. He wrote to students, he said, look, he said, don't argue, and don't be disrespectful to anybody, always be nice to people. And they don't accept me. He says, look, I know what I am. And I know that after I die, my works are going to be read and accepted widely. But you have to realize that during my lifetime, there's all this envy and animosity, and that's part of human nature. I don't expect the acceptance during my lifetime. And so it was, of course. Maimonides went down as one of the greatest scholars ever in Israel. And as a matter of fact, what they put on his grave was, from Moses to Moses, there has never been one as Moses. And it doesn't mean to say that he was greater than the prophets, but it means to say, in a certain sense, it was really Moses and then Maimonides, because Moses was the founder and the one that we gained the most Torah knowledge from, on the whole. And Maimonides really did the same thing, because there are not too many of our scholars that wrote that much in areas of philosophy and in the world of ideas. And Maimonides' corpus includes every aspect of Torah. So from Maimonides, we live off Maimonides, just like we live off Moses. So that's why they wrote that statement on his grave, to indicate his great contribution, not in terms of the person. No one was like Moses, and no one was like the prophets. Even Maimonides would never consider himself as great as a prophet. But in terms of what he accomplished for us, how he benefited the Jewish people as well as the world, there he's like a figure of Moses. And he wasn't accepted during his lifetime to the extent that he was later. There's a lot of opposition to him. But what 2622 is explaining about the last well was, finally Isaac made it. Somehow or other, he kept on plugging and plugging, and then he reached a point where he gained the world acceptance. And the world does accept people sometimes, even during their lifetime. It's a struggle, as I said, but he was successful in that struggle. And that's that whole chapter on the well. That's the importance of the idea that the Torah is explaining to us. Now, once he had made it, of course, he would never have been successful had he not had the appearance of Abraham. And if he would have just people would have said he was from Avimelech, then no one would have listened to him, and he wouldn't have been able to be successful. But since he had the appearance of Abraham, it reflected a continuity in the philosophy of Abraham, and once that continuity was established, then the system was able to go on. And it's interesting that the Rashi explains that there is a passage here that says, in the week before his reading, where a very strange passage, towards the end of the parsha we call Chaye Sara, which is 25:5-6. If you take a look at that, you'll see there is a very strange passage, a very strange verse. It says, "And Abraham gave everything that he had to Isaac." Now that itself is strange, because a person doesn't have to give things to his son. The son should inherit it. But here we see in 6 it says, "And to the sons of the concubines that were to Abraham, his other wives." It says that Abraham gave gifts. Okay? Rabbis say it really means one wife, or the wife was talking about. I'm not going to go into that point. It says Abraham gave gifts. Now, if you take a look at Rashi on that verse, Rashi says a strange thing. What are these gifts? So Rashi says, he gave to them the unclean name. Okay? And that is actually a statement from the Talmud and Sanhedrin, an unclean name. There, if you check the Talmud, Talmudic source, you'll see that Rashi says, what is the unclean name? He says, it has to do with, Shaden means, it means like the appearance of like devils, like superstitious figures. And Kishuf means Malicious means sorcery. So when we look at the verse, it sounds very strange. What did he give to Isaac? Here again, the oral law says he gave everything to Isaac. Everything implies even more than just his wealth. And it says, Rashi says, he gave him over the power of blessing. So he gave over the power of blessing to Isaac. So here we have these two strange verses. He gave the power of blessing to Isaac, besides all his wealth and his money, and then to the sons of the concubines, he gave this gift. What is the gift? Sorcery and demonology. Doesn't sound like a gift. It sounds like everything that Abraham was against. So what I wanted to say to explain these two verses is that when it says he gave everything to Isaac, what it means is the ability to give a blessing. Now, if you notice, when in the beginning of the reading of Lech Lecha, that's Genesis 12.
Rabbi?
Yes.
A question.
Sure, go right ahead.
And you need to break.
Go ahead.
All right. If he gave this gift of sorcery and things to the concubine, where did Abraham learn it?
That's a good question. I will handle that question. That's a good question. And the end of the verse, by the way, which I didn't read, it says, and he sent them away from upon Isaac his son when he was still alive to the land of the south. Okay? Land of the east, I'm sorry. So where did he learn the sorcery? I'm going to get back to that in a minute. But it says in the beginning in Genesis 12, when God told Abraham, he says, leave your house, your homeland, and the place you were born, the house of your father, and he says, I'll make you to a great nation. And then he says, he mentions to him, he says, and you will be a blessing. And being a blessing means, as Rashi explains, it means that you will be, when you will bless people, then he says, until this time, I was the one that gave the blessing. But from this time on, you are going to be capable of giving blessings. Now, a blessing to us is not a superstitious thing. I spoke about it at the convention. A blessing is when the Kohen enunciates the proper idea of what a true blessing is, and the person listens and receives this idea, then the blessing will be fulfilled. And he has to understand what the idea is, and this is what the good is in the Torah, and what God gives man. If he thinks into it and understands it, then God assists him. Now, over here, anybody can give a blessing, actually. Any person can give a blessing. But Abraham had a special power to give a blessing. What it means is that God knew, in order to make Abraham great, he's fighting this uphill battle. It seems clear from the Torah that if God would not assist him, Abraham would have lived and died as an unknown. Because as brilliant as he was, and as much as he had a few hundred people that followed him, but that would have died with him, and it never would have been successful. He needed something to bring him out onto the public stage, and to make him public arena, and to make him into an accepted figure. And that was the fact that he was very wealthy, which gave him a tremendous prestige. It says he was extremely wealthy. And wealthy is one thing, that's personal satisfaction. Extreme wealth brings a person honor. And this put him into the limelight, an important figure. People turn to a very wealthy person. They say, what has he got? He must be intelligent. People always think people have money are very intelligent. And then they turn to him. And also, when he gave blessings, apparently divine providence was with him, and these blessings were fulfilled. The reason was, again, in order to make Abraham great so that the philosophy could continue to exist. Now, here it says that Abraham gave over this blessing to Isaac. The power of blessing gave over to Isaac. It's interesting. After that, it was never given over again. It was not given over to Jacob. And the reason is, here again, the Torah teaches us an interesting insight into psychology, and that is when you have opposition against a system, and people want the system to die, like Abraham's system, they want it to die with the man, if it exists, if it can survive one more generation, then that type of opposition is gone. It's already established. So here there was a dangerous transition between Abraham and Isaac. Abraham knew this. That's when he told God, he said, I don't have a son. It's not going to continue to exist. So God promised him this son, but now with the son, you have to work this out. It's not going to just happen by itself just because he has a son. And he knew that if Isaac didn't have certain things, Abraham knew this. So Abraham, when he reflected in his mind, he realized that this gift that God gave him for, that he will have the divine providence when he gives a blessing, will be more than an ordinary person's blessing, that this must be something that is necessary for the system, and he realized that it must have been God's will that Isaac should have that same power. Again, here you see that God doesn't tell man, instruct man in everything. In Judaism, we don't believe that. God gives man a certain amount, and he has to use his own mind. If he doesn't use his own mind, that's the end of it. Whether it's prayer or any kind of system, you must use your intelligence. That's the first obligation that a man has. And over here, when Abraham thought over the whole incident and how God gave him this power, he determined that it must be that the power is not just to him, but the power will be given over to anyone that he decides to give it over with, namely, in this case, Isaac. So he told Isaac that he, from now on, will also have that ability. And Isaac gave blessings to people in certain instances, not just randomly. He used his mind and his intelligence to determine when is the proper time, and this blessing had a special divine providence attached to it, and it was fulfilled. But he established Isaac in that way, to continue in that manner, because he knew that the idea, when God said you will be a blessing, it must mean you insofar as the system is concerned, and not just personally. So therefore, he made Isaac follow suit the way, in his same type of activity as he used to do. And that's what it means, he gave everything to Isaac. The question was, the Talmud says a person is not supposed to try to cheat the system of inheritance, something we discussed at the conference. That's not a good thing, even though a person can. So they ask the question, say, Abraham here is cheating the system, because really, he's giving everything to Isaac during his lifetime so that the others don't inherit. But you have to understand that this was a unique case, because over here, giving over whatever he had wasn't just simply the material good. It was really to show that the only one that you could trust from now on, when I die, is only one person that you could turn to, and that's my son Isaac, and you can't turn to anybody else. Now, what it means about the concubine's sons, when it says he gave them over the sorcery and the other kind of things, it doesn't mean, you see, the rabbis say in the Talmud that Abraham had hundreds of books on idolatry. This means, as I said, he understood the nature of the primitive, and he understood the nature of superstition, how these things work. He studied these phenomena, and he used to explain it to people. And what he did over here was, the other gift that he had was to disclose to those children what the source of these primitive practices are, that they should understand these practices psychologically, how man gets involved in this kind of a thing, and how to avoid it. That's what he gave to them. That was the gift. The gift of sorcery means the knowledge of sorcery, and the knowledge of what goes on when there's a devil worship and all this type of thing. He explained to them how this works, and therefore, with that knowledge, with that gift, they would be protected from any kind of involvement in those type of systems. Now, the point that the Torah is making is that here, Abraham was involved again in transmitting the system. So to his son, he had to give his wealth, his position, his ability to function in terms of giving blessings, and to the others, he had to send them away. Not because he disliked them, because he gave them all the knowledge that he had to protect them and to have them continue. But as you see, it wasn't really successful. Because, as I said before, the Torah, as much as it respects knowledge, it knows that the battle for knowledge is an uphill battle against all kinds of odds. And I think you people know it better than anybody else. It's the most difficult kind of battle. And here, in order for the system to start off, to begin, it had to be nurtured very carefully. And the way God's plan was, and Abraham, of course, used his mind and his wisdom to enact the plan, is to make sure that the world knows there is one person that you're going to turn to after I die, that is Isaac, not the concubine's children. He had to send them away to make a clear-cut indication for the people that these are not my inheritors in terms of my philosophy and my way of life. The only one is Isaac. So that really is that really is what the Torah is teaching you. It teaches you he gave those other children the knowledge. He taught them to avoid the idolatrous practices. He explained to them. But as you see, they perhaps, we don't know what happened to them. maybe they did live virtuous lives, and it was lost somehow later in their offspring. Although the Ishmaelites really never became idolaters, so perhaps that was because of the teaching
Rabbi,
of Abraham. Yes.
Another question along the same line. If he sent these children away to show that that Isaac and his descendants were the true Masorahs, or the transmitters of the truths of Torah, then why did Abraham have these other children?
He remarried after Sarah. When Sarah died, he remarried. And the Torah believes that it's not a person is not supposed to be in an unmarried state. And this is actually a law, the Talmud, that a person, even though he's old, Maimonides states, and the Talmud says, that even though a person is old, he should not live alone. A person should, if they can, if they're capable of getting married, it is proper for man to live, in a married state is where man attains perfection. And as a matter of fact, the Bible says in the beginning, in Genesis, says God called their name man when he created man and woman. Talmud says their name, he calls their name man, indicates that you are not a man unless you have a wife, and vice versa. A woman is not fully a woman unless she has a husband. So that's why Abraham, after he lost Sarah, he remarried and had more children. That was fine. That's according to the Torah, that's the proper thing to do. Although, as Rabbi Soloveitchik says, if you look at the Bible with the sensitivity of a scholar, you'll notice that the moment Sarah died, and the Bible explains, he remarried, and he had more children, and lists the children, but you sense somehow or other that there was no divine providence involved. The divine providence was involved with Sarah. She was unable to have a child, and then God miraculously returned her to her youth and enabled her to have a child, and the story with Isaac, you could see when you read it that that's all divine providence. But then in just a few passages, he remarried, and he had children. That was a normal part of Abraham's life. Abraham, insofar as he was a regular person. But as soon as Sarah died, that was the end of the mission of establishing the next generation. And the reason is, as Rabbi Soloveitchik said very well, that in order to establish the ongoing generation, Sarah was just as necessary a component as Abraham. And here we have the Torah again pointing to the fact that man and woman are both equally important. And Sarah, as a matter of fact, the Bible says that God told Abraham, you listen to what she said. She had more insight into the situation of her two children, of Ishmael and her son Isaac. And she knew that this was a harmful relationship. And Abraham didn't want to send away Ishmael, as you remember. But God said, no, you listen to what Sarah says. And Rashi comments over there, and Rashi says that God said, Sarah is a greater prophet than you. And in that respect, woman has greater insight. The Talmud says that there's an additional wisdom that a woman has in the area of knowing human beings. In the psychological area, she has a greater sensitivity. And her role was just as important as Abraham's in establishing the next generation, which was Isaac. Once she passed away, that was the end of that era. He continued to live and have children just like any normal person would and should, but this was not anymore the divine plan. The divine plan was over. The only continuation of the divine plan was through his giving over to Isaac his whole situation, his position, and making sure that no one is misled into thinking that the other children are the authentic inheritors, the heirs to his philosophy. Philosophy was safeguarded. It's Isaac and nobody else. So, that basically is one point that I wanted to I want to just open up those few passages. Actually, it's based on that one verse of 25:19, the first verse. I wanted to get into some more if we have more time. But let me see if there are any questions at this point. I'll be glad to take up any questions that anyone may have.
All right. Any questions at this time? Anybody got them? Did he answer yours, Charlie? All right, Charlie said he didn't think you answered his question.
Okay, let me have it once more.
All right. The question, again, Charlie, is?
In verse 5, it says that Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac. If he gave it all.
Okay, if he gave all that he had unto Isaac,
right,
then how did he have anything else left for the concubine?
Okay.
And then the second thing that we looked at is that Where did he learn? You still haven't answered. Where did he learn all these things about sorcery, et cetera, et cetera?
Okay.
Those 2 points.
Let me take the second one first. Where he learned about sorcery was, as we mentioned before, the oral law, and Maimonides mentioned this, explains to us that Abraham was a small child. He was raised by his father, Terach, and he went to church. He served idols himself. He participated in the services of the church. In all the idolatrous practices, he was a member and a participant as a young man. Then as he started to grow, his mind started to become aroused, agitated, and he started to think, and he was able to see slowly there's something wrong with this. And until he studied all the practices, not only did he discover God, the real one God, but he was able to understand and to study all the practices that existed at that time, the sorcery, the magic, the superstition, the idolatry, sacrificing their children. He knew what these emotions were, where they came from, and he knew that they came from the internal part of man projecting onto reality something which is not true, but there's another part of man, which is the Tzelem Elokim, the divine element in man, which perceives God and understands what the truth is. So he really knew very well all these practices. He had studied, he had lived among it, among them, and he was able to realize that this is all nonsense. And
Rabbi, again, all right, over there.
I'm here.
All right, question that would come up here is, you said that he lived in this and participated in it, and yet we have been told that he learned about God when he was a little child.
Okay. The Medrash says that Abraham recognized God when he was 3 years old. That's a Medrash. Now, a Medrash has to be understood. Again, a Medrash we don't take literally. Maimonides explains that he recognized God fully when he was 40 years old. Now, realistically, you know very well that Maimonides' account is the correct account. What the Medrash means by 3 years old, the Medrash means that he was a person that from early on, his earliest youth, there was something in the back of his mind that was searching, that was always searching for God. A normal person doesn't really, he has a small time when he is, every child questions, but then they become subordinated to the system. So he subordinated himself to the system, but a part of him was always active and always agitated and always searching. And when he was 40 years old, that's when he actually came to the full realization. It took a man of 40 to fully understand his philosophy of the one God, the non-material God, what that means, where God is expressed, where do you see God on a daily basis? Because as you know, God didn't appear to Abraham for many years after he was 40. He was 75 when he received the prophecy. So Abraham's philosophy was not that you see God through miracles and through revelation. It was you see God in everyday life. God is visible in the universe. You see his wisdom, as King Solomon says, as King David says in Psalms. These ideas that he was able to discover God through behind the natural phenomena in everyday life, that was Abraham's discovery. As a matter of fact, when God told Abraham that through a miracle he's going to have a child, you remember very well, he laughed. He said, he didn't expect God to change the laws of nature. On the contrary, he realized that the laws of nature are expressions of God's infinite wisdom, and God doesn't like to change these laws of nature, and he didn't expect the laws of nature to be changed for him. That was the miracle that God did for Abraham, but it wasn't something that Abraham was even looking for. He wasn't looking for miracles. He didn't need miracles to see God. He saw God in everyday life. Now, you understand very well, to have a philosophy like that worked out is not something that a 15-year-old is going to have. And moreover, he understood the psychology of the idolaters, too. That's a very in-depth kind of thing, to understand how man works and why these primitive practices are the way they are. You understand that people are studying these things for centuries, even today, trying to discover what's the source. We find so many common types of things, taboos. Where does this come from? From the human mind. And the need for a physical God, for physical reassurance. Where does this come from in man? And you know, there are different views, psychoanalytic views, which trace it back to early youth. And we don't know in specific. I'm not trying to espouse a specific kind of psychology. I personally have my own opinions on that. But whatever it is, Abraham apparently had it all worked out and understood the philosophy
Rabbi?
Of psychology.
All right, Rabbi, I've got one more question here from Miss Gail Ledford.
I didn't answer the other question. The question of how we could have anything left for the other children, right?
Okay, you're going to answer the other question all right, first. Okay, go ahead.
When we say he gave everything, there are two types of things. There are material and non-material things. A person can... The material things are limited, but non-material are limitless. So when it says what he had to give over to the other children was not a material thing. It was ideas. And he taught them the underlying psychological motivations for the idolaters so that they would be safeguarded. So in non-material areas, there's always something more. It's not limited. Okay? Now the other question, I'm sorry. Somebody had another question.
Okay, here she comes.
Okay.
Why would he want to pass on to anyone, let alone his children, the idea of sorcery or anything non-related to God?
See, this is something I have to explain. This. I know it's a difficult idea, but it's one that is important, and I'm going to try to explain it as best I can. And that is that Torah believes, when Torah says, for instance, that a person shouldn't be an idolater, it's not enough, really, just to avoid the practice of idolatry. That's enough for an average person, fine. But the Torah really wants a person to have total knowledge. And knowledge means not just to avoid certain practices, but to understand where certain practices stem from in the human mind, and to understand why people do things that are wrong. When you understand why people do things that are wrong and what the source is, where it comes from, then you really are able to see the truth. It's not enough. It would be like a physician might tell you, well, avoid this type of food. It's not healthy for you and your condition. Okay, if you avoid it, you're not going to harm yourself. But that's with regard to a physical practice. With regard to a religious practice, it's not enough just to avoid it. It's important to understand what the source of it is. What is the attraction to it, to idolatry? Why are people attracted to it? This just sounds like an idle psychological question, but it's not. It's a religious question, because the more you understand what the source of that attraction is, the more you're able to understand how your emotions are going towards the wrong thing, and then you can correct it. So it improves you. It benefits you. For instance, by the golden calf. So it says before the golden calf, the Bible says that the people came to Aaron and they said, this man Moses, because this man Moses who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. Why did they make that statement? The answer is, there was a mistake that they made. They believed in God, but yet they needed a man. They needed Moses. Moses was more than just a person that conveyed the word of God. He was someone they believed in, and that was not right. Because belief must be only in God, and not in a man. If you need a man to support your belief, then you are weak. Then you're catering to an emotion which, in its full-fledged form, will eventuate in idolatry. Because that's what idolatry tries to do. Idolatry tries to give you a certain physical security. And we are required from God to rise above that kind of a temptation and to realize that God is non-physical, and yet I have my security only from him and from no one else. So it's important to understand the tendencies, the idolatrous tendencies. I'm not saying everybody has to understand this, and not everybody is capable of understanding it. But the great scholar is one that does understand this kind of thing. And the more knowledge a person has in the area of psychology, in the area of philosophy, this makes him a greater person. Because, as I said in the beginning, the important thing in Torah is to gain knowledge. So Abraham was a man who understood these practices, and he understood why people do these things and what the attraction of these things are from an emotional standpoint. So whereas from a perhaps a Christian religious standpoint, you say, well, stay away from that area. It's taboo. It's no good. Keep away. God doesn't want you to have anything to do with idolatry. The Torah has the opposite position. The Torah says, no, you have to understand what it is. The more you understand it, the more you'll be able to avoid it and be able to explain to others, to teach others how to avoid it. You'll see they have a hang-up in what's drawing them. You'll know how to approach them. And you yourself will be able to understand your own emotions. Idolatrous emotions are found in every human being. Nobody is free from it. It's a lifelong process for a person to work himself up to the point where he just has God in a non-physical form and he doesn't need anything else, and he has no leanings towards any other kind of support. I'll give you an example. The Talmud says that a person is not permitted to go to his friend's house before he prays to God. I mentioned that to him. Why? Because if my boss lives next door and I get up in the morning, I think, you know, I better go over and say hello to him. He's on his way out, and it'll be good for me to do that. That's idolatry. Why? Because here the Talmud says that, you should, to quote the passage, it says you're making man into an idol. Because the first thing, my first consideration should be, how is my relationship to God when I wake up? And even though there's somebody down the street that may even be the one that supports me, but that, if I go to him first, then it's an idolatrous type of thing. It means I'm looking for that physical security, and I'm forgetting about the security that comes from the creator of the universe who's non-physical. So idolatry is found in many different forms, and there are certain fine, sophisticated kind of idolatrous tendencies. The greatest person is the person who's completely rid of it. So it's not just a taboo. It's a part of our process of growth. And the more we grow, the more we remove these different types of support systems until we only have one support system, and that is the Creator himself. So it's really a process of study and investigation. Does that explain it?
Yes, I think that's got it. I got it. Does everybody else get it? Did you get it, Gail? So what you're saying, let me just draw a conclusion here. Then if we are going to help our family, our families that still are involved in the paganistic religion, idolatry we call Christianity, then we should have a thorough knowledge of it in order to expose the error of that way to them. Then we have to have the Torah knowledge to teach them the correct path.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the difficult thing to do. That is correct.
All right. Well, we got about 5 more minutes. You want to break it off here? You want to go on?
It's up to you. Are there any more questions that anybody has?
All right. Does anybody got any more questions? No, they're just kind of sitting here smiling.
Okay. If you want to, I could finish it off with I really wanted to do something else. I wanted to just take this for 5 minutes, but as it turned out, it became almost an hour. I'll take just a small point that maybe...
Okay, that'll be fine.
Okay. It says 25:8. It says that Abraham died, and it says in a ripe age, and it says old and satisfied, and he was gathered unto his nation. Now, old and satisfied is an interesting expression. What does it mean when we say a person dies, he's old and he's satisfied? Nobody's satisfied to die. As a matter of fact, people always think, you know, when you're young, you think, well, that old fellow, he was 80 years old and he died. Well, look, he's 80, you know, if I were 80, I'd be ready to go also. But that is not true. It's like, I forgot who said it, but they said, who wants to live to be 100? The man is 99. And that's true. When a person ages, contrary to what people believe, is the internal psyche never ages. He is the same young man as he was when he was 15 or 20. The only thing is that the parts of him that age are the physical components. And that's why old age is a very difficult state for people. Because what happens is when a person gets old, the satisfactions that they had and the outlets that they had when they were younger due to their physical condition cease to exist to a large extent. The older the person gets, the greater the extent. And life becomes very difficult. We have a Talmudic law that a person that's very old, let's say in his mid-80s, cannot be on the Sanhedrin, because the Sanhedrin, it's required, if a person on the Sanhedrin, a person must have compassionate feelings. And the Talmud says that oftentimes when a person gets old, he gets kind of grumpy. And this doesn't happen to everybody, but it's a psychological law, and the Talmud and the halacha has to follow general psychological principles, even though in particular it's not always true, because there can be great people that overcome this, which I'll discuss in a second. But nevertheless, the general principle is usually when people get older, they become less happy. Now, a great person, when he gets older, becomes more happy. And the reason is because a great person realizes goes more into the world of ideas and the world of thought. And the more a person goes into that world, the aging process is a blessing, because it removes him from the physical and instinctual pleasures, which really aren't true pleasures, because all the instinctual pleasures have pains that attend these pleasures. Every time there's a satisfaction, there has to be a desire. And a desire is always a pain, because when you desire something, by definition, you don't have it. So if you don't have something, you're in a state of want. Want is always pain. Matter of fact, I remember there was a student in my class who was a very wealthy young man. Father was wealthy, and it was very difficult to control him. He didn't want to study too much. So I one time asked him, I said, tell me, what do you want to be in life? This was just a few months, I couldn't control him. I said, what do you want to be in life? He said, well, I want to be a wealthy man. I said, do you want to be a wealthy man, a wealthy businessman, and be happy, or are you going to always keep growing in business? He said, I want to always keep growing in business. I said, then what you're telling me is you're going to be eternally unhappy. And she recoiled and said, what do you mean? How do you say this? I said, well, if you're telling me you always want to grow in business, what you're saying is you're never going to be happy where you're at. You always want to move ahead. So if you want to move ahead, you of necessity aren't happy where you are now. So you're telling me that you're destined to a life of continuous unhappiness. That idea shook him up so much, I finally got his attention for the remaining months of the year. But the point that the Torah is making here is that Abraham, when he died, he was old and he was satiated. This means that his old age was one that caused him to withdraw from the material world more and more, to involve himself in the world of thought, the world of ideas, the world of God, and therefore he was satisfied. Satisfied, Nachmanides says, means he didn't look forward to anything new happening. Most people, when they get up in the morning, they look up, what's going to happen more today? They're looking for some new thrill. We look at that as a part of life that's good, and perhaps it is good for us on our level. But Abraham was on a far higher level. He wasn't looking for anything new to happen. He was happy in the world of mind and the world of thought. He was totally satiated when he died.
All right, we got one minute, less than a minute.
I think I made it, right?
Excuse me?
I think I made it.
Yeah, you got it. We're right in there. We're still playing with this equipment. Maybe next week we'll have it worked out.
Okay. Are there any more questions? If there are any questions on this last point, I'd be glad to take it up, even though it's not on the tape.
All right. Okay. Are there any questions? All right. This will end this session then.
Okay.